The Polygon Show. I'm Simone de Rochefort, and I'm joined today by Allegra Frink.
Hi.
Chelsea Stark.
Hello.
And Ashley O.
Hello.
I don't like this voice.
I'm sorry. It's a new one. I'm trying it out.
Oh, okay.
You don't like it?
No.
Wait,
can you do it again? Hello.
Oh, it sounds like Crunchwrap. Keep talking.
I'm Crunchwrap. I'm hosting the Polygon Show today.
Okay, no, it's too baby to be Crunchwrap.
It sounds like Marcel the Shell, but...
the snail?
I don't know who that is.
Marcel the Snail?
He was a lonely snail? Yeah, he was a little shell snail with googly eyes and would have a baby voice.
I don't have
that's
any
actually,
friends.
That's actually... That's Jenny Slate.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes!
I'm Jenny Slate.
Jenny Slate from... Parks and Rec and
Je
other things.
Marcel
She's also dating Captain America.
She was, and they broke up.
But then I think they're dating again.
Oh. No, they started dating again, and then they broke up again.
No, they didn't.
The latest I've heard is they're still together again.
They didn't. I will accept that. That's the world that I'm going to live in. So today, you might not know it from everything that just happened, but today we are going to be talking about indie games. But first, a brief message from our sponsor, Microsoft Azure. Your business is built on bold ideas. Bring them to life faster, push them further, and scale them worldwide without skipping a beat using Microsoft Azure. Stay productive with familiar tools, develop and deploy where you want with a consistent hybrid environment, and build engaging apps with intelligent features. Join the startups, governments, and 90% of Fortune 500 businesses running on the Microsoft Cloud by starting your free account at azure.com/trial. That's azure.com/trial. All right, let's talk about some indie games. First indie game we're going to talk about is something that I think we've all played, and I imagine demographically a lot of our audience has played too, Gone Home by the Fulbright Company. Yeah, Allegra, you recently interviewed Steve Gaynor?
Yes.
That's the tone of voice for, am I getting this person's name right?
You sure are.
It's been like... How many years since Gone Home came out?
So it's actually celebrating its fifth anniversary. It came out in... August? I don't want to say the exact date, but it was mid-August.
It's that tone of voice, right? It's like, am I right?
Yeah.
August?
It came out in August, and sort of in celebration of the fifth anniversary, they just brought it to Switch, which is really exciting. And so in more because of the fifth anniversary and less because of the Switch port, I wanted to talk to Steve because, yeah, Gone Home is one of my favorite games ever. And one of the first like indie games I really, really played with like an awareness of indie games, right? I would be curious to know when you guys were sort of like aware of the dichotomy between like mainstream and indie, but I very distinctly remember sort of my friend who studied like game design in school. So he was into like a lot of different games, and he was like, hey, I heard about this game. It's like a big deal. And he was going to school in Seattle, right? Mm-hmm. And they're in Portland. You would totally like it. I was like, I don't know what the freak this is. It's not Pokemon. It's not like Nintendo. I don't know what this is. And yeah, and then I looked at the stuff he sent me, and it was like, you know, this beautiful kind of spooky house. There's all these like vintage 90s posters because it's in 95, and all these cassette tapes and music by legitimate actual like, you know, Pacific Northwestern Riot Girl bands. I was like, this is so my aesthetic. And it was like the first game I ever bought on my PC. Mm-hmm. I got Steam for Gone Home. Like, it's very influential, I think, for me. And I played it all in one sitting, and I was like, this is amazing. Like, I've never played a game so intimately relatable and like earnest and based on some kind of conceivable reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was talking to Steve Gaynor, I was kind of just trying to get the sense of like, I mean, you sort of, not single-handedly, but kind of helped influence this like sort of tide toward indie games, especially like that, like walking simulators, which is usually pejorative. Mm-hmm. But, you know, games like Firewatch and Edith Finch and that sort of thing that now are like very critically acclaimed. And very much like you describe a game like that and everyone knows what you mean.
It was so funny reading that piece because despite living through, obviously, because it was 5 years ago, that time, I completely forgot that it was so controversial at the time because, like you said, now there are so many games that follow that model of you're exploring an environment and learning the story from walking through this space.
Right.
And I'm not familiar enough with games pre-Gone Home to say how common that was, but it definitely did kind of thrust that kind of game into a major spotlight because it was so acclaimed. And so, of course, then you got the contention of people going, hey, this is great. And other people going, that's not a game. What are you talking about? So it kind of like just put a match to that whole conversation.
Yeah, it's so interesting, right, to like be that vanguard. The same friend who recommended Gone Home to me or like told me, yo, you got to pay attention to this, was also interested in the games that Steve mentioned as like precursors. So there was Dear Esther.
That was like a Half-Life mod, built in the Half-Life engine with a mod tools, right?
Is that the one made by the people who made Everybody's Gone to the Rapture?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so that game is very much, both of those games are very much like, you're just straight up walking.
Yeah. Like there's not a lot. Very slowly.
Yeah.
And that's the Chinese Room, who I think just got bought by Microsoft.
Oh, yeah, I think they did.
Oh, no, they got bought by Suwa Digital, which is a first party studio that is making Crackdown. So like that's the Microsoft connection.
Right.
Which is weird.
Also Sonic Team Racing.
Yeah.
What? Oh no.
All of this is like the weirdest like spider's web of connections.
Okay, they made Amnesia a machine for pigs too.
Right, yeah. So Amnesia and Dear Esther were like the specific predecessors that Steve Gaynor called out as like these are games where there isn't really combat. You just kind of walk around and like they were both very polarizing when they came out. Like,
any of y'all played Amnesia?
Mm-hmm.
It's scary.
It made me really nauseous. It was one of the free, PS Plus games earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I played it on PS4 for a bit, but it was super just nauseating to.
I don't think that port is good because I remember trying to basically play it on a TV with a controller, which it's not meant to be played as originally. This was years ago, mm-hmm. and it was like so janky.
Yeah.
And also probably the most scared I've ever been in my life.
The Chinese Room didn't make the original Amnesia. They made the sequel.
Sequel, right.
Yeah. Which I haven't played, but I have watched it, and I don't think it was as scary as the first one, having exclusively watched and not played Amnesia games.
The first thing that I did with that was way before when it first came out, and I was so like, this is going to scare me. I'm very bad at horror games. So I did the most opposite thing I could do, which was, I was like, I'm going to just watch a Let's Play through with Markiplier.
Oh my God.
And I was like, this is probably the best way for me to watch this, me a baby, watch a full grown man screaming.
Yeah. It's therapeutic in its own way.
It's the most messed up thing about that game is you only learn later is like the first three levels, you'll never actually get attacked by the monster. It'll just like tease you and you're like, but it was too scary.
It felt real.
It really felt, and you're like hiding in a cabinet and you're just trying to pull that cabinet closed behind you.
Yeah.
It really like that.
Don't invalidate my emotions, Amnesia.
I just love that they made, I mean, they definitely made mechanics that have now been pulled on by so many games of like, you don't have a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
You are totally helpless. And also you get more crazy. I mean, like not crazy, crazy, but like your
character's emotions influence.
Thank you for the saying gameplay. That more articulated.
Hey.
So good. But yeah, you're the more stressed you become and mm-hmm. like you hear characters like teeth grinding and stuff like that, and that just was so it kind of really influenced the other, like, I think senses that we see in games like Hellblade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
for sure. That was a very audio heavy game, which I don't know if people kind of knew about that from the get-go. Like, I think it was kind of marketed as having 3D, you know, binaural sound, and it, like, I had to unplug my headset a couple times because it actually got just too scary for me. And like, that's it. Only some, I think, like, yeah, only the hordes, like, they're just like hordes of enemies that come at you at some point, but then like boss fights, but those are so minimal, and most of the time you don't have access to a weapon and you just have to listen to this thing and like literally grope in the dark. Like, it's dark, you kind of see a shadow, but then you have to just listen, and then you hear things like around you that are moving like clearly towards you, and weird,
horrifying,
inhuman noises.
Yeah, so like that game definitely influenced by Amnesia. The Alien Isolation definitely also kind of borrowed the, like, the hiding thing. Soma. So those are the predecessors to Gone Home that kind of, I guess, led the way for that strolling through a virtual world and feeling horrified by it, because despite not being a horror game, Gone Home is fucking horrifying.
That's what I was saying.
It makes you feel like something's bad.
I thought it was a horror game when I played it, when I was playing it. Yeah. I didn't know what it was, and I was like, what's going to happen? And like, every room I went into, I should have really honestly looked something up, but I stupidly didn't. Yeah. And the whole time, I actually spent more than half of the game like waiting to like discover her dead body or something. I really thought that that's what was going to happen.
Yeah. I know. It just like, I have such a fear of, you know, turning on lights in empty houses when I know I'm alone. And it kind of takes the language of horror games and puts it in a non-horror game. Yeah. And I guess it works, because even if I, you know, I as a person in my life, if I were in that scenario, knowing that my life is not a horror movie, I would still be horrified by just having to go through the fucking basement of the house that I haven't been in before. I would have sat in, I couldn't have sat in the living room, because then I would have not known what was in the rest of the house, and somebody, a murderer, could have been in there. In real life, I think I would have walked right back out the door and like called a taxi, whatever. It was 1995. They don't have cell phones. I would have gone to a hotel. I would have been in the Days Inn. I
thought you were going to say they didn't have taxis.
The Days Inn! Damn!
Oh, man.
Throwback. Oh. The sequel to Gone Home. Days Inn.
You're just in a search for cookies the whole time. Yeah. Wait, that's Doubletree. Fuck.
It's okay. I was just going to accept it and just laugh.
Wait, cookies?
Are there cookies at the Doubletree?
Doubletree's whole thing was that they would have warm cookies at the desk.
What?
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Are you kidding?
No!
It was like a marketing thing.
What?
Wait, is it still like that or no?
I don't know. Are there still Doubletrees?
There are.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, maybe it's still there. Simone looks like she's furiously
Googling. I'm trying, but I don't have enough time. I don't have enough. Oh, okay. The cookie's only the beginning, Chelsea. They are known for their delicious warm chocolate chip cookies baked fresh daily. And they are proud to greet their guests with something sweet at check-in. Okay, so now I know. But also, it does mean much more. I'm not going to tell you about that right now, though.
Okay, this episode is not sponsored by Doubletree, unfortunately.
I wish they had sent us cookies.
We're going to record the next episode in our shared Doubletree suite eating the cookies.
Anyway, back to Gone Home.
Faith. In a tub full of cookies.
All wearing robes.
Disgusting. Oh, yes. Sponsored by Doubletree.
Yes.
We have chocolate chips all over our faces. Doubletree
episode. Welcome to our meetup at the Doubletree Hilton Hotel with cookies. Gone Home. It cannot be ignored that, like, the whole crux of the story of that game is like finding out through journals and stuff that your sister is gay and has left home with her girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's not incidental to the polarizing response to it, because it kind of had that element of like, not only is this the gameplay, it's like basically a 3D point and click game. Not only are the mechanics quite minimal, but also it is SJW trash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And right, this
I
was
say
like,
ironically and untruthfully, this it's 420.
Oh,
blaze nice.
It. This was right before Gamergate. You guys can blaze it
as I talk about this.
But this was right before Gamergate. But even then, it's like the bubbling underside of like people.
Well, it was
being
literally
anti.
right before, right?
No, it was the year before.
Yeah. It was like,
thank God.
But yeah,
it was
like
the next
that
summer.
Yeah.
Kind of set a stage, I think. 2013. Yeah, it was exactly the summer before Gamergate happened.
Actually, kind of cool thing. I think I left this out of my story, but I was talking to Steve Gaynor.
Wow.
Steve Tainer about the
yikes.
Ew. And I was saying, like, yeah, I'm sure, like, specifically the LGBT themes, like, those felt really novel at the time, and I'm sure, like, that plays a very heavy part into the polarizing aspects. But he was, like, so chill about it. He was just like, yeah, I just kind of want to like write or make games about people and lives I am not experiencing, being that I'm a white heterosexual man.
Yeah.
So I just thought this would be interesting. And he also mentioned, like, yeah, I'm still searching stories like that. Like he said, one of his favorite games of last year is Butterfly Soup.
Yeah.
So we were geeking out together.
That's really cool.
But it's cool that, like, I don't know, for a lot of things, it's such a, like, belabored, monumental decision. Like, I'm going to make a game, but the character is gay. And even then, like, in Gone Home, obviously that was, like,
gay.
Obviously that was, like, a considered conclusion, and it was meaningful that she was gay. Mm-hmm. But, like, it wasn't this huge thing where he, you know, wanted to bring it up and, like, talk to me endlessly about the... Mm-hmm. rarities of queer characters and games and such.
Surprise. In a world where your sister,
do you want me to get that little gay noise from the trailer, like movie trailers, just like recut the Gone Home trailer with like the Inception.
Oh
my god.
I'm sorry, we have to go deeper. All right, let's have an email about indie games, though, because we're still on topic. This is from Adam. Not Adam Musa, but a different Adam. You're also a good Adam. Email Adam. Anyway.
Wow.
This is from Adam. I've been playing indie games almost as long as I've been playing games. I picked up Braid in sixth grade, and since then have been playing indie games arguably more than I've been playing larger titles. Now I'm getting to the age where I've started meeting game developers my age and may even start making my own games. Yay! Congratulations, Adam. While I could gush about all the queer and experimental indie games in recent years, I wanted to bring up an aspect of indie games that I feel like isn't taken as seriously as it should be. Browser games, specifically Flash games. I spent hours upon hours playing games on websites like Newgrounds. Early on, the games offered a place for childish expression, but eventually that grew into a fascination and love for games. Sure, a lot of them are flaming hot garbage, but I also discovered the work of Anna Anthropy and would check Nitrome weekly. It's hard to forget bonding with school friends over Ski Stun Simulator and finding what websites weren't blocked on the school computers. Do you have any browser game memories? Thanks, and don't let anybody scuff your shine. Adam. Aww. That's so great.
Scuff your shine.
I was so happy when this email arrived like mere hours before we recorded this podcast because I was like, holy crap. Yeah, actually, I think you can certainly like Anna Anthropy, who they mentioned, definitely an indie creator. But a lot of those browser games of our youth, like, where did they come from and where did they go?
Well,
this Cotton is Joe the second one. Time.
It is you've not mentioned Cotton. The second time, my friend.
It's an everyday for me.
That you mentioned Cotton Eye Joe.
Cotton Eye Joe?
Maybe it's the second time you've caught me.
Oh, no.
Wow.
Where do I come from? Where do I go?
Damn. You go out the door. That's okay. Where you go.
Goodbye.
Oh my god. So my personal choice for the best browser game of all time is Winter Bells. It is a game by, the website is called like Fairy Halsim or something, and I'm totally blanking on what the actual like guy's name is right now, but it's a bunch of, I believe they're like Korean games, and they're all very simple. It's like either jumping to collect things.
Yes, from Arisenal.
Arisenal.
Yes.
Yes.
I was literally, as you were typing that, I was like, oh, I remember some browser games I used to play. I think they were Korean. And I was just typing that as you were saying.
Yes, exactly right.
Yes, I relaxing Korean browser games. Arisenal, yeah.
And my favorite was Winter Bells, which was like so cute. Had the best relaxing music. You're playing as a little snow bunny. And you just kind of like jump on all these bells and you try to keep doing that, like chaining them. And if you fall, you just fall very gently back to earth. And I was very, very good at that game. I think my high score was like over 2 trillion.
Jeez. What?
It just sounds like you're making stuff up.
No, it's two real.
That's my high score. It was over 2 trillion billion dollars.
I have a picture of it somewhere.
Snow bunny dollars.
Yay.
It was 2 trillion. But the thing that's cool about that game, speaking about Adam, you know, being making their own games now, is I was in a meeting to check out some new game, and they just so happened to mention like the person's name, the Arisinal person. And they're like, oh, I don't know if you've heard of them. They used to work for this thing called Arisinal. I was like, what? You seriously? Like, Winterbells is one of my favorite games ever.
Like, real people make these?
Yeah. And they were like, oh, yeah, we recruited him. He's like working at our legitimate game studio now. And I was like, that's amazing.
I want you to know that I'm playing an Arisinal game right now. And it's the one where you stretch the giraffe's necks to make them kiss.
Aww.
I like that we have all yelled at Allegra for playing games.
Listen. I gotta stop. It's really good.
Oh my,
it's so
cute. I feel like I have seen a totally different era of browser games, and I wish I'd played these.
Me too.
Yeah, like this is a classy browser game. There are some not so classy browser games.
Well, like,
games out
I
there.
Just definitely remember having to navigate through a lot of like pop up stuff and. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it just feels kind of janky compared to that beautiful, smooth giraffe kissing game.
There was a terrible, I mean, like, this is the 90s, I'm thinking 90s, and there was a portal literally called board.com.
Yes!
Yes! Yes!
Board.com!
Board.com. And you played the lemonade stand game on there. Oh, I played that all the time.
Explain the lemonade stand game.
You were
game.
Just, like, basically trying to calculate how much lemonade you could sell based on the weather and other factors and, like, other things like that, but it was only text boxes.
Oh.
I think.
Oh my god,
it was really hard. I was really bad at it because I guess I'm not a.
So board.com still exists.
Yes,
oh, and yeah. There are 24 results for lemonade on it. So I have no idea.
I have no idea. I mean, I don't. I think this is not a novel idea. I'm pretty sure this
of course,
is like a bunch
yeah.
of different things, like drug wars esque almost, but. Yeah, I remember.
Do the kids these days still play these like janky browser games? Like,
I
no, right?
Because
we have like Fortnite.
Yeah. Yeah, but also there's still, like Adam was saying, there's still kids in classrooms who have only certain access to certain things, you know, mm-hmm. and they've got a school computer and they're taking computer science or newspaper or whatever the fuck.
But they've also got their cell phones.
They do have their cell phones.
I will say, though, but by the time I got to high school, I don't know if that's true for you too, Simone, like people were just downloading Peggle and Halo onto the share drives. Like we weren't even playing browser games as much.
I mean, we did that with Unreal Tournament in my computer.
Yeah, yeah.
It was not, I feel like that is a cross-generational. Yeah.
The only thing that I remember doing on school computers was watching the Watchmen trailer.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
You never did anything else.
Thrilling.
Every time I got in the computer lab, I would just boot up the Watchmen trailer. No, I don't know what I did on the computers at school.
I just remember a very specific pre-trials bike jumping game that was extremely janky and like the physics were so wild and it was in the browser, but I don't know the name of it. But this would have been like around 2000, so...
I don't know if I'm pretty sure what I was playing was a strange bootleg from somewhere, but it was a match 3 Pokemon game, and I was in like maybe 5th or 6th grade, okay? Mm. And then the thing is that as, you know, like the Pokemon are dropping, you know, when you would match 3, like all three of them, you know, instead of being the Pokemon, like that row would turn into Pokeballs and they would be spinning. And every time you match 3 and that happened, you would hear, Pikachu?
What?
And so, like, when you started getting into the advanced stages, it became like, Pikachu. And it would just, like, get really crazy and you're like, what? And then eventually whoever else is in the room was like, what the fuck is that? What are you... Anyway,
what knockoff madness!
But it was really, so really addictive. Like, I mean, I would after school go over to Helen's house and we would play this for hours.
Oh my god!
Helen's parents horrible. Must have been thrilled. Just like, holy crap! What? Also, sound files were not that good then. Like,
nothing was good.
It
then.
Was like it was pretty loud, you know?
Yeah.
And then I think in the corner was a Pikachu, like. Oh my god, it was balancing a Pokeball on its head, so it would kind of sway from like side to side. And I'm pretty sure that was a large element because like every time I see that gif of a Pikachu going side to side balancing the Pokeball, like it brings back these really like huge, vivid memories. And I know it's really significant, but it's not. It's significant in that I really wanted to win at this game, but there was no winning. It's like Tetris. It was weird.
I don't know where we got this game.
How old were you again when this happened?
Maybe like 12.
Oh, holy crap. Okay, and in terms of actual good indie games that you played, Ashley, you wanted to talk about Sword and Sorcery.
Wow, what a sharp turn.
Sorry, I didn't mean to diss the strange knockoff Pikachu game.
It's fine.
That I desperately want.
Maybe I shouldn't be talking the name about it. Oh, I don't know. It just, you clicked on an icon on your desktop and it popped up.
Listeners, I need you to find this weird Pikachu game for me because I really want to play it.
All match three games are so addictive to
They're
you.
They're great. And it's just, I've been off match three for a long time. But Sword and Sorcery.
Broken your addiction.
Tell us about Sword and Sorcery, Ashley. Opposite.
Yeah, similar to, you know, what Allegra was saying, that really kind of was the first game that really challenged my idea of what a game is. And I know that sounds so stupid.
We all have that, though.
But, like, I think this was a period where, like, I wasn't really aware of that many indie games, and I didn't really know how to access them. Mm-hmm. And I actually got this, like, my friend had, I don't know, I think, like, gifted it to me on Steam because he was talking about it. And then I realized, like, first it was frustrating to me because I was like, okay, well, what about the fighting? Like, what do I do here? It seemed really non-linear.
What is the gameplay like? And
the gameplay is very, like, you kind of just, it's like a point and click mostly. And you go around, like, sometimes you fight, but it has that, how do I describe this? Like that muted, pixelated,
kind of like a 16-bit, but
it's
very like,
but it's very toned down.
It's called something
desaturated.
Like, not desaturated. It's like almost like D retro or something. I can't remember the name, but it's like specifically those games that look like lower than 8-bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I mean, everything about it is really beautiful, though. I mean. And the music is fantastic. That's like another thing. But I think, you know, sound and music in that game was such a big element where you just kind of, you have to like click and hold down and then it'll emit like, say, like a song or something. And so I think like there was a huge gap between me playing this and playing Journey because this sounds very much kind of like the experience Journey has where, you know, it was less about any dialogue in this game. In fact, there was like pretty much none. And it was more about eliciting a feeling to me, I think, and like the way, I don't know, like that's why the soundtrack was so instrumental in the experience, though, because, you know, a certain song would start up or certain kind of variations of noises would happen as you're like walking through and interacting with objects. And it seemed like it was mapped in like such a like seamless way that it was just kind of part of it and like you were just moving through it. And so that didn't really occur to me. Like, I think at first I was trying really hard to grasp like, okay, but like what is like the story or what is the meaning and like, what do I have to do? Yeah, exactly. So then, yeah, it just became a lot more about I guess really listening to and paying attention more to like the sounds and the music that were in the game because there was such little else, like little else to focus on. That,
like letting it take you to that different place.
Yeah. And I think like it did a great job of kind of like not really like burning into your brain, but like a specific like really nice scenescape, landscape or something, and then a particular song. And then as you're navigating through it, it's like that's what you are paying attention to, like your how your progress kind of follows along with the progression of sound and music. Mm-hmm. And like that was a super kind of like emotional experience, and it was nice that it was wordless mostly. So I think that's what I really loved about that game.
How do you think it's going to translate to Switch?
I don't know.
Since it is coming out on the Switch, which means that's, I'm going to play it.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely recommend playing it for sure. I mean, because its mechanics are so simple, I'm sure it'll be fine.
I wonder if, like, Jim Guthrie, the musician, is going to make more stuff. Because he apparently, I just looked at, and he's also done the music for Reigns, Her Majesty.
Yeah.
But nothing else.
Hmm. Yeah, he's not done a ton of work. He's done some work in between that in terms of like games.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I couldn't find other stuff on his Bandcamp, and that's where I went. So yeah, I'm trying to think of what else he did. But he's so
great,
atmospheric.
Yeah, I love his style. He's so good at capturing like... I mean, even if you listen to each song on its own, I feel like you can already sort of picture what colors you would see anyway and what kind of textures you would see. And that's why I really liked, his like songs are very good.
So since you're listening to this podcast, listeners, I'm going to say that the title of the game, if you're not familiar with it, it's Super Brothers Sword and Sorcery, but sorcery is spelled with it's S-W, sorcery, like sword, but sorcery. So if you're like trying to look it up, actually Google would probably help you out here. But if you are trying to look it up and it's not coming up because you're looking up the actual word sorcery, there's your problem.
Oh, also that is a capybara games.
Oh
game.
Yeah.
So like they're, God forbid,
Below. Someday Below will Below. Come out.
But yeah. Like what we did play at PAX though with Below, it there was a similar ish feeling. Yeah. I mean, not as much, but like
there's
in terms
a lot more
of
fighting in that game.
Oh yeah. But like the aesthetic and stuff.
Yeah, the aesthetic. They make great stuff. Mm-hmm. So we are going to be back to talk about Celeste in just a moment. But first, coming up, we have an advertiser segment brought to you by Microsoft Azure about what makes a city, quote unquote, smart.
In a city, everything we do, from swiping a ticket at the subway turnstile to checking into the public Wi-Fi, is a piece of data.
In just the last 2 years, we've produced more data in the world than the rest of the years combined. We're getting into multiple petabytes, even exabytes of data.
That's Rohan Kumar. He's vice president of Azure Data at Microsoft. And that's exabytes, as in 1 megabyte with 12 zeros at the end. It's a lot of data.
And with this volume of data comes a lot of potential for intelligence. When we say, how do you make the data intelligent? It's really about getting into a single place where you can run machine learning models which derive artificial intelligence from that data to make it more meaningful.
One application is making our city smarter. Eyal Federlevy is the CEO of Zen City, a startup that's trying to make the data-driven city a bit more intelligent by adding people to the mix. Zen City takes a pulse of what's on the city's mind through social media. And then they analyze that data for insights using Azure services.
Posts, comments, 311 calls to the call center. We use machine learning to turn all of that huge mess of unstructured data into actionable, quantifiable scores and measures that can actually support decisions in the local government.
Those millions of data points can help city governments understand what their citizens need.
When we had big snowstorms in the U.S. this winter, we saw some of our cities actually use our platform to recognize areas where more people are talking about being stuck in the snow and prioritize snow removal. There's so much data being created around every action that we take in life. The real question becomes what we actually do with it.
Learn more about the tools you can use to make sense of the world and your business with Azure. Start free at azure.com/trial. AZURE.com/trial.
Welcome back to the Polygon Show. I have here an email from Thomas. Again, not Thomas, former Polygon intern, just like Adam is not Eater social media manager Adam Musa. It's really, I don't know why they let people reuse names. Clearly, like sometimes it's just very confusing for me and no one else. Anyway, hey, Polygon Show. Love you, Thomas. To say that 2018 began very roughly for me would be an understatement. Amidst the longest and most brutal winter I had ever experienced after 2 years in New York City, I also found myself befallen by many dark turns. I was fired from my job. My roommate was going through a bout of depression. I was experiencing deep creative stagnation on a personal project. And my grandfather died, putting me at his funeral on my birthday. So when I started playing a beautiful yet highly frustrating Celeste, due to the high praise from gaming reviews, I didn't expect to have my entire experience with all of these personal dark life turns made positive by my time with a redheaded pixel art girl. As someone who does not really experience clinical depression, I was unable to empathize with my roommate who was going through it. Celeste's journey taught me so much about what it feels like to go through that experience. Pushing myself to climb that literal mountain in the game despite the endless frustration and failures inspired me to find motivation and inspiration in my personal work again, along with sending out endless applications to land what is now my favorite job yet, working on Marvel shows. Congrats. And playing Celeste on my plane rides to and from home to go to my grandfather's funeral comforted me deeply when I would have otherwise been lost in the darkness of my thoughts. Needless to say, I think this game is a genuine example of how video games can truly be art, storytelling, and interactive emotional support for life. Thanks, Thomas. Thank Aww, you, Thomas.
That was beautiful, Thomas.
Yeah. God, it is great when a game comes to you at exactly that right time, like Edith Finch definitely was for me. And it's also great that it was on Switch. Because, like, it's so hard when things, I guess, are gated to, like, a bulky computer or a home console or something, and you can't have them, like, when you need them, like, on that plane ride. It's so important. And I personally identify Celeste so much with the Nintendo Switch that when I decided to play it today so that we could talk about it on the show, I literally, like, I did not even think to look for it on Steam. I was just like, okay, does somebody have their Switch in the office? I forgot mine. Does anyone have it here? And then I remembered, like, oh my God, you fool. Just get it on Steam. Play it on your freaking laptop.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also thought it was...
Exactly.
After the fact, I felt so bad because I was in a meeting when you were looking, and I have my Switch with Celeste on it. I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I downloaded it on my laptop, tried to play it on my laptop with a mouse and keyboard, which is the worst thing that I've ever tried to do in my life.
Whoa.
And then we switched to the computer in our, like, work computer, which has the controller hooked up to it.
Okay.
But I'm pretty sure it'd be 1,000 freaking times better on Switch. But yeah, so this email, I guess, touches on something that I hear from a lot of people who love Celeste, which, because it's a massacre game and it's really freaking hard, you wouldn't think it would be soothing. But everyone I talk to who loves it is like, oh, actually, you get into this very kind of chill state and it feels good to play it.
And it's also one of the games that's got a really nice meta theme about, you know, Celeste, the mountain. But, I mean, like, dealing with the anxiety of it, because it's, like, something that the main character deals with through the whole thing. And you're just, like, it kind of pairs that metaphor so nicely with the gameplay. And that doesn't always, you know, sometimes that feels forced, and this one doesn't. It feels really good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it could seem very unsubtle in that way.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's the way it's, like, parceled out is so wonderful, I think. Like, it starts out very much like, this is going to be a hardcore game, we're climbing a mountain. And then it's, like, slowly the story starts to unravel and you realize, oh, she has panic attacks. Oh, there's a reason she's trying to do this. Also, it's just, like, a really funny game. But I think the best part that makes it soothing, because I, like, got really, really into it kind of recently, just like picking it up again, and, you know, I'm bad at games, so I don't like to play things that are hard, but it has those accessibility options, right? And so, you know, if it is getting brutal and painful, you just turn on infinite stamina and, like, you know,
dash to your heart's content
and immortality, and just, like, it's fine, then it's fun, and you get to just experience, like, fun level design and art and stuff like that. Yeah. So I can understand why Thomas would be able to find a game like that soothing, even if it's known to be very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Just also that sense of achievement when you do it.
Yeah.
Like, that's, you know, as I've talked about my growing love for hard games, and that's not something that I always appreciated, and I have, especially with Hollow Knight and Monster Hunter. Mm-hmm. But, like, that feeling of, like, oh, I did this on my own, and I learned how to do this thing, and it feels so good. Just, yeah, like, nothing, I don't know, there's no greater satisfaction to me than that.
I think what's great is that it contrasts, this is just for me, like, how fucking brutally hard it is and it has like the most soothing, wonderful soundtrack.
It is so lovely.
It's just, I just want to listen to it all the time, and I do, but to have like that in the background as you're attempting this, I feel like adds to this chill factor.
Mm-hmm. Does it make you feel extremely pumped if you're just doing normal things to that soundtrack and you're like, I can do this?
I need to try that. Because like, you and I, Ashley, I think we're the two people who do tend to get a little more stressed out by Celeste. We, at least I, speaking for myself, I have not accessed the chill zone yet. Again, I just started trying to play it today, so I'm a little bit keyed up over it. But even so, I did experience like that satisfaction of, because every section is just one screen and you can get through it so quickly once you know how to do it. It's like, oh, that was nice. What a nice little like hit of success. And it's so pretty and it's so soothing. I should keep, or not soothing, the music is so lovely. I should keep going, even if like the gameplay itself can, if you are of a certain character type, lead you to feel a bit of stress.
The problem with Switch and handheld is it's like so easy to want to throw it.
Yeah.
Oh no.
I've never thrown my Switch. I'm just saying, like,
I just remembered really, really quickly another thing I really like about Celeste that's really positive is like whenever you reload or like start a level up, it's like, you can do this, don't worry about it, come on. And it's like very encouraging. And I just was like, what's the game that does the literal opposite of that? And it's Robot Unicorn Attack.
Ha!
Which every time you start, it's like, you will fail. You're going to die.
Perfect browser games.
Yes, 100%.
Oh my God.
I loved that game so much.
Again, where did it come from? Where did it go?
I loved that one.
And that one got pretty big for a while. Like, I remember they released it on mobile.
It's an Adult Swim game.
Yeah. Damn, that was a good game.
With that great song.
They made a sequel, and then I don't know anything about that. Like, if it did well or anything at all. Yeah.
God, I used to play that for hours.
I want that on Switch.
Now, why did I play that for hours? And yet, I'm sure I'll get into that mode with Celeste. It'll happen for me. I believe in myself. I want to be soothed. All right. This next email is from Victoria. Hi, Polycrew. In the last episode, episode 66, you were all talking about a weird stigma about how being a girl who plays video games does not make you cool, and how boys ignore you if you try to make conversation with them. That really struck a chord with me. I relate to how Simone says that she didn't really play games as a kid. In a similar way, I wasn't allowed to play games as a teenager, and it astonishes my friends when I say I haven't played such and such popular game as a kid because I wasn't allowed to. As an adolescent, my mom didn't approve of me playing video games, citing that they are childish and unladylike. Because of this, if I wanted a game, I'd have to save up money myself. Thank you, Nintendo, for never going on sale. Granted, I played games all the time as a kid, but I was known as being a weird girl who likes Neopets and Super Mario too much. Kids can be cruel. I remember being at my friend's 12th birthday party sleepover, and there were a lot of girls there that I knew didn't like me. I spent much of the night playing Paper Mario until one girl came up to me, dropped her bra on my head, and then walked away.
What?
Kids are so fucking mean.
Is that even a burn? I don't understand.
It is. Because it's embarrassing.
It is embarrassing, but also
why? What's it embarrassing for, though?
I more or less stopped playing video games after that. It was only until I was a senior in high school that I finally got my own computer and thus could buy games on Steam with my own money. I fell back in love, and now it's one of my hobbies / favorite things to do. Anyway, sorry for ranting, and thank you for fabulous ladies for being the most relatable games podcast ever. Much love, Victoria. So we have determined that Victoria is not the one who should be embarrassed.
Yeah, I don't understand. You are not the one who should be embarrassed. It's bra dropper lady over
bra here. Bra dropper.
Why would you take off your bra and then throw it on someone?
Or was it like a playful suggestion? What's going on?
Ew, they're 12.
I don't know, man.
I don't think I wore a bra when I was 12.
Yeah.
That's a whole other...
Also, the use of the word drop. I'm curious about if just it was just sitting on her head.
You know...
I guess so.
This really reminds me of something, though, because I do feel like you guys had the, you know, situations where you felt, like, uncomfortable talking to guys about video games, but I felt very similar to Victoria, where I felt like girls would be far more judgmental when you were that age, when you were 12. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember having Star Wars swag and, like, getting made fun of in middle school.
Yeah.
Right?
lame. Like, I think for me, if I were a 12-year-old and a girl that I knew didn't like me dropped her bra on my head, that would be upsetting because I wouldn't, like, because I wouldn't understand the intention. They'd be like, what does this mean? Is this embarrassing for me? And if so, why? Like, it's terrifying to not understand the social rules that are happening and to know that you're being laughed at but not really understanding, like, but why? What is this?
Yeah. Like, what is wrong?
Why don't you like me?
I'm doing.
Yeah. Is it because I'm playing Paper Mario? What, like, why is that the thing? Oh. Anyway, being a teenager is terrible. And I'm sorry that happened to you. That's freaking crappy. I hope Bra Girl thinks back on it.
So weird.
But now Victoria has their own
video
laptop?
Games. Yes.
Yeah.
So, computers. Like,
It's, you know, this is a story of redemption.
And I think what I wanted to, like, segue this into is the growing, or not growing, but, like, more visible world of indie games that do explore issues like growing up being a lady, like Nina Freeman's games. What a terrible segue. But there are a lot of games now that explore sexuality, like Robert Yang's games, which explore, like, vignettes of being a gay man. Nina Freeman's games, which can be about, like, puberty and crushes and learning about what sex is, which is another traumatizing experience of youth. God. That I think we can all remember. So yeah, Allegra, tell me something about Nina Freeman.
I was going to say I'm a Nina Free stan, but bad. But I'm a big Nina Freeman fan, and I think it's exactly what you're getting at of, like, there is this, I think for a long time, like, as we've experienced and as Victoria's talking about, right, it's like there's this weird stigma of, like, games are for the guys. And I think a lot of that was because there weren't games. I mean, not that there were games so explicitly about being a young man, but there weren't games very much about being a teen woman or, you know, a young woman or budding woman or whatever. A young budding woman.
Ew. Let's unpack that phrase.
Why?
Makes
let's strike that.
Quite no. Let's
episode title.
Put a timestamp on
budding
that one.
Budding woman.
But anyway, so I think Nina Freeman is probably the first really high-profile person to do it. It wouldn't be fair to call her the first, obviously. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she's around our age. She basically would do these games that were, like, for free and had really beautiful art and just were very, very specifically about an intrinsically female experience, like what you're talking about of, like, you know, learning about what sex is from a female perspective. Mm-hmm. And the first Nina Freeman game I really played and that I still think about a lot, it's really short, so you guys should play it. It's like 30 minutes and it's free. It's called Freshman Year. And so she wrote it, and then her friend, who's like a comics artist, illustrated it. And that's sort of like a dialogue-based game, sort of. Like, you choose different dialogue options. And it's so specifically about being, like, an 18-year-old going to your first college party and, like, the shit that can happen to you when you go and your friend is really drunk and isn't texting you back, and then you're by yourself and you're kind of drunk and you've never been to a college party before and you've never drank before and you're drunk for the first time, and then some guy is trying to take you home. Like, that kind of experience that I mean, I'm sure it happens to guys in some way, but I would say every woman I know has had that happen to them. And to see that in a video game, which, like, is interactive and gives you agency, and having been written by someone of that age so authentically, was like, oh my God, like, games can very, very accurately and astutely tackle this. And so Nina, continuing from there, like, has just made games that, like, have her very genuine voice in them, which just is so relatable on this broader spectrum of, like, being a woman around that age. And yeah, Freshman Year for me was, like, the first time I played a game where I was like, oh my God, this, I literally experienced this, like, last semester or whatever it was.
You said that amazing. She got you back into video games. So what, like, what period of your life was that?
So I think that was a combination of Gone Home and Nina. So Gone Home got me into games when I was in college, but, like, I still didn't have time. And then I think right after I graduated college, when I had lots of time, I played all of Nina's free games. And then Sybil came out that year. It always happens like that, where like you find a thing and it's like, turns out this person's making their first album in 10 years, right after you discovered them.
It is always like that, isn't it?
Yeah. And then like she was part of this really awesome indie exhibit they have every year from NYU Game Center called No Quarter. She released a game at that one that year. So like all these different things were just happening in succession where I was like, I just want to stalk this person. And every single project she made was about like having awkward sex or trying to avoid some dude trying to take you home or you know, body image. That one was really striking. This game called Manja, that's a Twine game. But yeah, so I think then I was kind of bored with like RPGs or the Pokemon style of thing and finding these very narrative based games at a time when all I wanted to do was like read and cry was a nice combination of like, you know, finding the relatable people and things that you could need at a time like that. And also marrying that to like the interactivity and fun of the video game. Yeah. It was really cool to find. And now that's like all the kinds of games I play. Other than Metal Gear Solid, which
you,
is weird.
You own that genre, that beat.
Yeah, I think it would be... I feel like, aside from Robert Yang, who's like doing this kind of thing for gay men, there's not a lot... Like, there are very masculine games, but none that I think address male anxieties as much as Nina Freeman's games address anxieties that are very relatable to young women, if that makes sense. And I wish that men could also explore their vulnerable emotions in a way like these games, like some of them just kind of like rip you open and
yeah,
I mean, I feel like
stuff a feeling in there.
You know, the issues that we're having with masculinity and like certain pop culture, I feel like is actually doing a little bit to hammer, break that mold apart.
For sure.
But we haven't like we haven't reached that with video games, and I think that would be really exciting. Yeah. There could be stuff. I mean, I haven't played a ton of Final Fantasy 15, but I do feel like they were talking about a lot of like having male friends and having close male relationships. Yes. Like, and kind of how sweet that could be. Like, that, there's a lot of that in that game. But, it, you know, also through the Japanese culture lens, so it's a little different.
I also feel like sometimes if it is there, it's a little... It can have a tendency to be very, like, in your face about it. So, you know, that's an example, though, you know, noted that it's, like, a it's Japanese culture, really, with the whole, this is my bro, these are my bros. I love them, and it's okay to love them. But aside from that, there's like God of War as a fantastic example. It's like, I mean, I'm not saying, what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say like he starts out right with the very obvious like cold stereotype of a distant like man, not in tune with his emotions whatsoever. And then, you know, I think even in the ending as well, which I thought I enjoyed actually very much. I didn't think that it was like corny at all. I thought it was just fine. I thought it was perfect. But like, you know, I think sometimes the way they can display certain like progressions, right, of going from cold and hardened to feeling something just seems like, okay, we're moving at a slow pace. So, oh, what? 60 miles an hour? What? And then all of a sudden we're here where you're just like, bam, okay, yes, vulnerable. Wow, I love you, son.
It's exactly that, because it's like men have to go on an emotional journey to be able to express their emotions. And supposedly women are already there. Like,
we're already at the top of our journey.
It's just interesting. And I know this is like very, and I feel like it is gender essential. Like, obviously, people who are perceived as women are more encouraged, or expected to be more emotional, B, encouraged to talk about our feelings together, expected to express our feelings together, if not, you know, anywhere else. But it is interesting that, like, what you were saying, Ashley, of if there's going to be a male character addressing his emotions in a game, he has to work up to that. That has to be his character development.
Well, not only that, but in the middle of that, like, really fast, or I don't know, arc, right? Mm-hmm. Say from start point A to point B, that part in the middle, like towards the end, where they really just kind of speed through it, mm-hmm. and then they kind of break through the other side. I'm more interested in seeing, like, okay, that part that you're speeding through, like, that's what I want to see, like the meat of the progression.
Yeah.
Of like you, if it's going to be about you having a journey to express your emotions, like that's fine. That's one mm-hmm. thing. But I want to see you like actively struggling, getting like.
Where's the journey?
I need to, like, yeah. I'm more interested in seeing like how you can demonstrate someone at like just visible conflict with themselves and not through some like fucking huge ass metaphor where you're fighting a big scaly dragon. It's like, no, I just like want a man to look in the mirror and just be like, what am I doing? Is this like, or I don't know, just them working it out.
Yeah.
I think too often there's like, here's this big quick time event. Oh, wasn't that crazy? Oh man, we could have died. Oh, I could have lost everyone. I love you, son.
Do you think any of the Persona games did that? Because some of the male characters do kind of struggle with themselves, and like especially with 5, you have like Ryuji mm-hmm. and Yusuke kind of dealing with these parts. And I don't know if it was always elegant, but at least it was definitely times where it was like, oh, we're in the mess.
Oh yeah, I think they did a great job of that for sure, of like showing them kind of at this point. And the shame of that is that they are still not like they are the main characters, but they're still kind of on the side, right? These are side stories. And like your character is just this kind of like blank slate, which I know why, but what if we had a game where the protagonist was Ryuji or another side character and we played through like their trials and tribulations of like going through high school, and like guys also have a tough time in high school. I mean, they also mm-hmm. have to like navigate things. I mean, I'm just saying, like, what about, like, there's, like, a hyper-masculinity sometimes with, like, having, like, the guy there. It's usually, like, you know how, like, Atreus, like, always wants to be, like, I want to be this big, tough guy. Mm-hmm. I want to be this, but what about when you're vulnerable sometimes and you're, like, is this what I want? Is this me?
You know what, Ashley? You've brought up a great topic for us to discuss next week in JRPG Week.
Oh.
Why are you going to be here?
I'm sorry.
Okay. I think I was pulling up the list of topics so I could decide if we could move JRPG Week so that Ashley could be here. But I don't... Pokemon Anniversary is after that. And it's Pokemon Week at Polygon.
We can't move Pokemon Week.
We can... We'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out. Anyway, so going forward now, I will say, if you want to talk about JRPGs next week or... potentially in the future, you should email polygonshow@polygon.com with stories about JRPGs. And I hope that you like this discussion about indie games, which I think turned out really good.
Yeah, it was
y'all,
interesting.
We did a good job.
Right? Yes.
Ashley's just looking kind of quizzical.
No,
yeah, I feel like we stumbled upon a whole other like wormhole of really interesting things to talk about with masculinity in games and how it's expressed, which I want to think about constantly. Thank you for listening to The Polygon Show, and thank you so much, everyone, who sent in your stories. We really appreciate it. And like I said, you can email stories always to polygonshow@polygon.com. And if you liked the show, you should rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. And you should also tell a friend about it and get them to review the show. And that way more people hear about us and it raises visibility and we all have a very good time. Thank you, everyone. I hope you like this conversation about indie games. This has been The Polygon Show. Before we go, here's a quick message about Microsoft Azure. Keeping up with your competition is important. Taking the lead with unmatched innovation? That's impressive. Set yourself up to achieve more by running your apps on Microsoft Azure. Clear the way for unparalleled productivity with end-to-end development and management tools. fearlessly integrate cloud capabilities across your environment with the only consistent hybrid cloud. Build the next generation of smart apps, discover transformative insights through artificial intelligence and real-time data, and scale across more global regions than you'll get from any other cloud provider. Microsoft believes every business and every organization, small and large, old and new, has something to gain by reaching beyond the limits of an on-premises data center. That's why Azure is the cloud for all. What will you achieve when you come to the cloud? Start experimenting and find out. Get started with a free account and 12 months of intelligent services at azure.com/trial. That's AZURE.com/trial.